Hello, it is Sunday afternoon, September 19th, 2004, and this is Harry Brown, back with an hour of conversation about money, your investments, your savings, the economy, anything having to do with money and the economy. And today we're going to be talking about gold, precious metals, inflation, and some things about these various subjects that you might not have heard before. Then again, you might. Well, you're just going to have to stay tuned and find out, aren't you? If you want to join the conversation, ask a question, make a comment, whatever, then just call 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. You also can email me with a question or a comment, and that address is question@harrybrown.org. question@harrybrown.org, and Brown has an E on the end of it. Well, as I said, we're going to talk about gold, precious metals, inflation, and so on, and hope to answer some of the questions, such as why hasn't gold done more during the past 3 years of uncertainty in the world over the terrorist attacks and the war on terror and so on. You'd think this would be a good time for gold, or I should say many people would think so. And why is it that inflation hasn't come back when the Federal Reserve has been pumping money into the economy as though it were going out of style? And I hope to answer these and other questions during the course of this hour. Let's begin by looking at precious metals in general. Some people expect precious metals to move together, that gold, silver, and platinum are all forms of the same thing. They are not. They are quite different. Each has a different use. Each has a different purpose. Silver is no longer a monetary metal. The use of silver for monetary purposes is very, very slight. Some people keep silver coins from the pre-1965 days in order to just have some special spending media in case the economy should break down. And that's about the extent of the monetary use of silver in the United States. In case you didn't catch what I was saying, in 1965, the coins, which used to be 90% silver, dimes, quarters, and half dollars, suddenly turned into copper nickel with no silver in them whatsoever. So in order to have silver coins that are real silver, you have to have coins that are pre-1965 dates. But other than a few people holding them in that way, silver is not a monetary metal anymore. Silver is primarily an industrial metal. And as an industrial metal, its price depends upon supply and demand, production and consumption. The production of silver being from mines, from recycling processes, and so on. The consumption of silver being for industry, for use in film, electronics, and a lot of other uses of silver these days. Now, back in the 1960s, it was recognized by some people that the consumption of silver was far outrunning the production of silver, and silver was being held down in price to $1.29 an ounce by the United States government dumping tremendous quantities of silver on the market. Silver it had acquired over 100 years by propping up the price of silver through purchases from silver mines around the country. But once that supply of silver disappeared, then the price of silver started rising. It reached a high of $48 in 1980, then came back down to $5, which was a more realistic price for silver. And it had gone up just because of the excitement over gold and other things during the 1970s, but it was not a reasonable price for silver to be at $20, $30, $40. But when it came back down to $5, it pretty well had brought production and consumption into harmony. Today, silver has risen from there and fluctuates around $7 or $8. That is because consumption has continued to increase faster than production. But there are still people today saying that there is a worldwide shortage of silver, and that is not true. And as a result, silver will continue to rise or fall depending upon the production and consumption statistics, the consumption and production forces that exert their way on the price. Platinum is also an industrial metal, and its future depends upon the production and consumption of platinum. It has no monetary uses whatsoever, unless you want to call platinum coins that are sold as monetary uses, but they're not really monetary because these are not coins, they're tokens. They are commemoratives. They are not used in purchasing and other forms as a medium of exchange. They're just simply used as commemorative coins, a way of holding platinum. And so platinum is primarily an industrial metal with no monetary significance whatsoever, while silver is an industrial metal with a little monetary significance. Now let's turn to gold. Gold is precisely the opposite. Gold has industrial purposes, but those industrial purposes are far dwarfed by its monetary usage. Gold still remains in the reserves of governments all around the world. It still is in great demand by individuals as a store of value, as even a medium of exchange in some cases, but more as a store of value, as a hedge against currency, as a way of holding wealth. And I would say, just picking figures out of the air, that gold is 90% monetary, 10% industrial, whereas silver is 90%, let's say 95% industrial, 5% monetary. Platinum is 100% industrial, 0% monetary. Now, what I'm saying is, of course, that these metals are different and should not be considered to be the same thing, and you should not think of one as a pure substitute for another. If so, why do they move together in price? Well, as a matter of fact, they don't. If you look at long-term charts of gold and silver, say going back to 1970, you may be surprised to find that they do not move together, that gold will find itself in a mini bull market while silver isn't doing anything, that silver may be going up when gold is flat, or gold is even going downward. And you find that they are moving together approximately maybe a quarter of the time, and three-quarters of the time they're moving in different directions among the three possibilities, an uptrend, a flat trend, or a downtrend. You don't find them moving in the same kind of trend very often. And people still assume that they move together because it has just been a matter of lore that gold and silver are both precious metals and therefore they are both going to move in the same direction at the same time. All right, we've established that the three metals are not the same. We want to focus our attention on gold. And the next question is, why hasn't gold risen more when we've had so much crisis in the world over the last 3 years? This is Harry Brown. Stay tuned. Give me a call if you like at 1-800-259-9231. But whatever you do, don't go away. Welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and today we're talking about gold, other precious metals, inflation, and various subjects related to that. We just discussed in the first segment the fact that gold, silver, and platinum do not move together, and they don't because gold is a monetary metal and silver and platinum are industrial metals. So if you expect gold to go up, it does not necessarily mean that silver is going to go up or vice versa. The next question is, why hasn't gold done better over the last 3 years, since we know that crises are good for gold? Well, as a matter of fact, we don't know that crises are good for gold. Crises are good for money. When people see a crisis in the world, a war breaks out, they're afraid, they don't know what's going to happen, they feel very uncertain, they turn to money. They want to get their hands on money because money is the great liquidity. Money gives them the independence to be able to move in any direction. If all that you have is tied up in real estate or cars or houses or other things that can't be turned into money at a moment's notice, you are immobile. You are not able to move. So during a time of crisis, people want to turn as much of what they have into money as they can in order to be able to have that freedom of movement. Now, the question is, what is it that people turn to when they turn to money? Well, they turn to primarily the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar is the number one form of money in the world, far more so today than gold, the euro, the Swiss franc, the British pound, the Japanese yen, or anything else, the Iranian rial or what have you. The fact is that the U.S. dollar is kept by lots of people around the world who are not even Americans. People holding it as a store of value, people holding it as a hedge against their own currency, people holding it because it is used in international trade and they're involved in international trade in one way or another. So there are great holdings, as you well know, of U.S. dollars outside of America. Not all of these holdings are by governments as part of their foreign exchange reserves. So much of them are held by individuals and companies. Now, when there's a crisis in the world, when a war breaks out or the appearance of a war breaking out or whatever it may be, the demand for money goes up around the world, and that means the demand for the U.S. dollar goes up. So when there is a crisis, normally the dollar rises in foreign exchange against other currencies around the world because people are suddenly exchanging their own currencies for dollars. And when I say people, of course, I'm talking about some people, not all people, not even a majority of people. Now, that's all well and good, but then what happens when the U.S. dollar seems to be threatened greatly by inflation? When inflation in the United States is getting to be 5 or 6 or 7 or 10%, at that time, people are not so sure that the U.S. dollar is what they want. And so, as a result, what they do is they turn to the second most popular form of money in the world, and that is gold. What happens is that people holding U.S. dollars will suddenly exchange some of those U.S. dollars for gold because they are afraid of holding too much in U.S. dollars when inflation is threatening the U.S. dollar. Now, when we talk about inflation, I'm not talking about 1 or 2 or 3% inflation like we've had in the United States over the last few years, but rather when inflation is moving up the way it was in the 1970s. And at that time, gold breaks into a bull market. When inflation gets to be 5 or 7%, then this is very, very good for gold, and that's when you see gold really take off. And gold is highly leveraged in the sense that if inflation is 10%, for instance, you're not going to see a 10% increase in gold. You're going to see a doubling, tripling, quadrupling of the price. And if we have 10% inflation in the United States again in the next few years, what's likely to happen is that gold is going to go to $1,000 or $1,500 or $2,000 an ounce. That's not a prediction. I'm just simply saying that the increase in gold will be far beyond anything registered by the inflation rate. So the point is this, that when inflation is threatening the U.S. dollar, then crises are good for gold. They are just icing on the cake for gold. But when inflation is very low in the United States, nothing that happens in the world is going to be particularly bullish for gold. As a result of that, we do not have inflation now. And one of the things I want to discuss as this program continues is why we have not had more inflation in the U.S. given the increases in the money supply. And that's something we need to understand as well. But let's take a phone call right now and interrupt this monologue. We'll talk with Robert in California. Good afternoon, Robert.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
Just fine. What's happening
today? Is it okay to be off subject here a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead. We'll take a break from the subject.
I have a couple of permanent portfolio questions for you.
Sure.
Or do I miss your newsletter? I have to tell you.
Well, Robert's referring to a newsletter that I gave up back in 1997 after 23 years of publishing it, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, not me. Couple of questions. On the permanent portfolio, you recommend various funds. And I'm wondering if since you've stopped publishing, any of those funds have changed. I know I got out of the Tudor Fund because they sent me a letter that they were changing their investment philosophy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there are any others I should know about that I should get out of the ones you had recommended.
Well, since I recommended those funds back in the 1980s, there has been a tremendous growth in the S&P 500 index funds. And today, for consultation clients, I just simply give them the names of eight of those S&P funds and suggest that they divide the stock market portion of the permanent portfolio among two or three of those funds. And all of the major companies like Fidelity and Dreyfus and Merrill Lynch and so forth, each of them has an S&P 500 fund, and that emulates the stock market exactly. So when the market goes up, your fund goes up. And we didn't have that with the other funds before, but before the S&P funds arose, those funds that I recommended were the best that were available. Hang on, Robert, and we'll continue this conversation when we come back from this break. And you hang on, too. This is Harry Brown. Join me if you like at 1-800-259-9231. Well, welcome back. Harry Brown here, and we're talking with Robert on the telephone. And, Robert, did I pretty much cover the question about...
Yeah, so my question, my further question then would be, should I get out of the other funds that were recommended, like Manhattan, Evergreen, Columbia, et cetera, and get into the S&Ps for the stock portion of the permanent portfolio, or just leave it?
Yes, I would. I do not want to make it too complicated or too cumbersome, because one of the objectives of having a permanent portfolio is to keep things simple and not have to continually make changes. And the only changes that I have made over the years, as you know from having read the newsletter, were in the direction of making them simpler and more effective, but not just because of the performance of particular elements
of it
during any particular time. And I do think that today, definitely the S&P funds are a better gauge of the stock market because they track the stock market on a one-for-one basis.
Mm-hmm. Is there a list of those funds anywhere?
Yes. Email me and I'll send you a list of them. If you will, just email me at question@harrybrown.org, and I'll be glad to send you a list.
That would be great. Now, the other thing I noticed is the 30-year T-bill is no longer offered.
Right. But
what do we do to replace the bond?
Well, right now, the longest bond available is about 27 years, which is long enough But when you get down to about 20 years, then you need to replace it with whatever is the longest that the Treasury has at that time. And I presume that they are going to keep offering 25-year or something of that sort so that we're not going to be confined to shorter length maturities. I can't swear to that. I have no idea why they stopped offering the 30s, so I have no idea what they intend to do for the long term. But for the time being, it's not a problem. It won't be something that has to be faced for another 7 years.
Okay, great. One other quick question. You can't predict the future, but I'm pretty well convinced that government will continue to get bigger. Is there any way to speculate?
That's a pretty safe prediction.
So I was wondering, you know, how would I speculate on that?
Well, there are no ways to speculate just on the general principle that government will get bigger, but there are ways of betting against the government. Richard Mayberry's newsletter is based on that whole principle that U.S. foreign policy is such a mess that there are various defense stocks that are going to be doing well because the U.S. government gets itself into situations like Iraq, where it is totally unprepared because it has not been setting itself up to fight a desert war. So what kinds of things is the government going to need? And he looks to certain companies that are producing the things that government's going to need in the situations that it's gotten itself into. That's one way of betting against the government. There are other ways, but the point is that you have to do it on components of the government. There's no way that I can think of offhand to simply place a bet that government's going to get bigger. And if there were, you'd have to be giving somebody 10-to-1 odds, because there's probably hardly a soul in America who really believes government is going to get smaller. So you only make money speculating when you are hold the minority. Right, not when you have the majority view.
Yeah, I see. That's funny. Any chance you'll ever bring back the gold trust?
The gold trust was a product of Terry Coxon's. I'm not entirely sure what happened to it, so I shouldn't say anything because I may say the wrong thing. I was not involved in it. It just simply took advantage of it while it existed. And there was some kind of a legal problem with it that the government stepped in and created a problem for it, as I recall. But here I am already making guesses when I shouldn't
right.
be. But I doubt that you'll see it again, at least not from Terry Coxon. Maybe some other company will find some way to do it.
What was just appealing to me is that it made adjusting the gold portion so easy.
Yes, it was a way of buying small quantities of gold, buying and selling small quantities of gold very easy without having to get into gold stocks or any other kind of substitute. Robert, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, Harry. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Glad to hear from you. All right, we were talking about inflation and why it has not come back. Well, yes, the money supply has increased, and most people who get involved in these things and learn about them learn at some point that inflation is a monetary phenomenon, that as the money supply grows, inflation grows. But in fact, there is more to it than that. Money is an asset, just like cars or houses or food or anything else. And as a result, its value depends upon both supply and demand. And what happens, unfortunately, is that people look only at the supply, and necessarily so, because only the supply is statistically computable. The Federal Reserve can tell you down to the last dollar what the money supply is in various different definitions, M1, M2, and M3, but nobody can, in the same way, calculate the demand for money at any given time, so the demand is ignored. Now, what is the demand for money? The demand for money is simply the desire of individuals to hold on to liquid cash, to be able to have that independence that I spoke of, to be able to move in any different direction that seems to be called for. And metaphorically, it is money in the pocket. But, of course, it's more than that. It's money in checking accounts or perhaps with credit cards that provide available credit at a moment's notice. It is not money in investments. It is not money in savings. It is not money in worldly goods or investments. It is money that can be spent immediately and therefore provides the greatest kind of independence and security. Now, what happens, of course, is that the more uncertain the world becomes, the greater the demand for money. The more individuals are afraid and they want to keep maybe 2 or 3 or 4 months' worth of money readily available in case they lose their jobs or in case their investments plummet or whatever it may be. They are now much more anxious to have money, and so what we think of as the demand for money rises. Now, as I said, we can't measure that because it's a psychological feeling. You can measure it in retrospect, or at least get a quasi-view of how the demand for money has changed over the years. And, of course, as inflation grows, people lower their demand for money because they're afraid of holding money that is getting less valuable as time goes on. But in the other way, when life gets uncertain because of various events and inflation is not ravaging the dollar, then people's demand for money rises. And I think it's fair to say that the demand for money has been rising over the last few years as fast as the money supply has been rising, and so the value of money has not dropped, meaning we have not seen serious inflation. We'll continue this when we come back in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show. Give me a call at 1-800-259-9231. Well, welcome back. This is Harry Brown. This is the Money Talk Show, and we still have a couple of segments to go. We've been talking today about gold, inflation, and precious metals in general, and I was saying in the last segment that what has happened over the last few years is that the Federal Reserve has been cranking up the money supply to try to get the economy going in the face of the recession that started at about the turn of the century, and which was aggravated, of course, by the uncertainty created by the 9/11 attacks and the subsequent war on terrorism, which has put America in a constant state of crisis and made people afraid to spend money. So the Fed has been printing the money at a rapid rate. It has averaged about 7% a year if you use a 7% growth rate every year if you use M2 as the guide. And at the same time, however, Americans have been just soaking up that money and putting it in their pocket, so to speak, and not spending it, so that the growth rate has not had the impact on the economy that the Fed officials might have wished. Now, this situation doesn't have to go on forever. President Bush says that the war on terror may last throughout our lifetimes, which is just such a wonderful, optimistic view of all of this and makes us just want to go out into the street and dance for joy. But the fact of the matter is that it doesn't mean that people are, even if he's right about that, it doesn't mean that people are not going to adjust to this and return to normal at some point. At some stage, people are just simply going to say, well, look, civilization is going to survive. I can get by on less money in my pocket than I did before. I can use that money for investments. I can use it for purchasing that home I've wanted or getting a better car or whatever it may be. And at that point, the demand for money will begin to fall and the increases in the supply of money will have a bigger effect in creating inflation. So somewhere down the road, inflation can come back. And I, of course, do not believe you can predict the future. So I'm not going to tell you when it's going to be. I'm going to keep that to myself. Oops, no, I didn't mean that. I'm not going to keep to myself. I don't even know. It might start next week. It might start next year. It might be a couple of years away. It may have begun a few months ago, and we just have not seen it yet. We just simply don't know. But there is no reason that inflation can't come back and create another bull market for gold. In the meantime, however, as I've said before, I believe that the best thing you can do with the money that is precious to you is to keep it in a balanced, diversified portfolio that's made up of stocks, bonds, cash, and yes, gold. I believe you should hold some gold at all times because you don't know when things are going to change. You don't know when the markets are going to turn around. And that's why I suggest the permanent portfolio concept, which Robert was referring to in his questions on the telephone. The permanent portfolio simply says, with the money that is precious to you, the best thing you can do is to divide it equally among stocks, bonds, gold, and cash, 25% in each. The stocks can be in S&P 500 index funds, which, as I said, all the large companies have, Dreyfus, Fidelity, Merrill Lynch, Schwab, each of them has an S&P 500 fund that matches the performance of the stock market almost dollar for dollar. The bonds can be in long-term treasury bonds, which don't have any credit risk. They, of course, have the risk of market fluctuations like any bond does, and they have the risk of being affected by inflation like any bond does, but they don't have the credit risk that other bonds do because the federal government can tax or print to pay off the principal and interest. And one of the virtues of a permanent portfolio is that you shouldn't have to pay attention and monitor all of these investments all of the time. Gold should be in gold coins or gold bullion, not in gold stocks or rare coins, because you want it to be focused on the gold itself, not on the management of companies or people's perceptions of what constitutes rare coins. And the cash should be in U.S. Treasury bills, again, to avoid the credit risk, either U.S. Treasury bills, one-year bills that just roll over every year as they become due, or in a money market fund that invests only in U.S. Treasury bills. And that's my permanent portfolio concept. Then if you want to speculate, take some money that you can afford to lose, keep it separate from the permanent portfolio, keep it in what I call a variable portfolio, and if you lose all the money in the variable portfolio through poor speculations, don't replenish the variable portfolio by taking money out of the permanent portfolio. The variable portfolio is for money that you can afford to lose, and you can bet on anything you want, speculate on the future, react to somebody's predictions, whatever it may be. All right. We have another segment to go. If you want to ask a question, call 1-800-259-9231. Otherwise, I'll take an email question when we come back. This is Harry Brown. Don't go away. With that happy music, I welcome you back for the last segment of The Money Show today. This is Harry Brown, and I want to thank John Harmon for taking care of everything in Minnesota, and I especially want to thank you for tuning in, and I thank our sponsors for making all of this possible. I particularly like that commercial about the dog trainer. We haven't used that on our dogs, but my wife has used it on me, and it has made me far more obedient than I was before, so I highly recommend it. I got an interesting email question from Dave in Phoenix, who says, I have always wondered where all that money goes when a stock market crashes. Obviously, it was there once, but if you look at your portfolio, it has vanished. Where is it now? Money heaven? Well, there is a problem here in that there is a distinction that must be made between money and wealth. We can't confuse the two of them. When there is a crash and the values of things drop tremendously, no money has been lost in the sense that the money has not disappeared, the money that was in circulation. What has dropped and what has been lost is wealth. And wealth is a psychological value to a certain extent. The wealth consists of the money we have in our pockets plus what we believe the value of our various assets are, the home, our investments, our other personal property like cars, computers, and things of that sort. And what has happened when there is a huge crash, a deflation or whatever, is that we still have the money that we had before, but the assets that we had no longer have the value that we thought that they had. We cannot exchange those assets for as much money as we thought we could. So the money hasn't been lost, it is the value in the assets that has been lost, and that is what we think of as wealth, that value in the assets, and that wealth has gone to heaven, but it goes to wealth heaven, not to money heaven. I hope that clarifies it. And what is happening, of course, is that as long as times are good, the value gets sustained and the money turns over more rapidly and thereby helps to put more and more value, apparent value, into assets. Once again, what happens during a crash is that the demand for money rises tremendously and people are not willing to exchange that money for investments. And so the value of the investments falls and the value of the money increases accordingly. I hope that answers the question. And I hope that you will come back next Sunday and we'll be talking about something different, a different aspect of money, the economy, your investments, and your future. This is Harry Brown, and I just want to remind you, you got to come back next week. Come back. Come back, sweet papa. Have a good week. Goodbye. Papa.